This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the writer Ali Smith. Her novels and short stories have won lots of prizes and endless admirers. But for an author of her stature, she remains intriguingly shy of the publishing publicity machine, believing that the more readers know about a writer, the more it gets in the way of their stories. Born to an English father and an Irish mother, she was brought up in the Highlands of Scotland, on the banks of the Caledonian Canal, reading from the age of three and writing her first poetry at eight. If this all sounds achingly Arcadian, it wasn't. Her mum had been a bus conductor, her dad was an electrician, and little Ali was the youngest by far of five kids, something of a surprise baby. She says of her work, stories can change lives if we're not careful. They will come in and take the shirts off our backs. Tell the right stories and we live better lives. So welcome, Ali. It's a very interesting thing to say, this idea of telling the right stories. Tell me more about what you mean by that.
Stories are incredibly powerful. In fact, we think we live and we're just living, and we're just living along, going from day to day. Actually, we live by telling ourselves stories about the lives we are living, and we take in like sponges the stories that come at us on all the waves, and all the radio waves and the TV waves and the internet, all the ways. Everything's a kind of story, which all adds to the story of, which is supposed to be the story of each individual's life. So it's not surprising if the stories are good and they come into us and we're the sponges that take the stories in, then we'll feel better about it. And if those stories are coming into us and us being so porous, if we aren't careful with our stories, then we'll probably block our pores, you know?
If there are right stories, then by definition there are wrong stories that can do harm. Now, that seems quite a curious thing for a writer to say.
We have to know that our lives are narrated to us, and also the way that we narrate the lives around us.
Yes.
It's all construct. As soon as we become aware of that, we can do whatever we like with the construct. We can change it if we need to. We can stay with it if we like it. We can change bits of it. So in other words, it gives us a kind of empowerment. So if we're not careful, they'll take the shirts off our back. But if we're careful, the stories will see us through like boats, you know, on whatever, you know, surface the sea is doing, you know.
We've got a treat of a list in terms of your music today. Do you listen to music while you're writing then?
Not while I'm writing, no. I think if I was listening to it while I was writing, it would remind me I was here, and I would listen to its rhythms instead of the rhythms of the sentence, because music is all rhythm. It goes straight to the heart, but so does writing, so does speech, so does syntax. It comes straight from the heart. They're really related.
Tell me then, Ali Smith, about your first track this morning.
My first track is Julie Fowlis singing Long Du, which is the Gaelic version of the Beatles' Blackbird. Last year I had one of the best jobs ever. I was offered the chance to guest direct the Brighton Festival, which meant that I had the carte blanche to invite anyone I liked from all over the world, and if they said yes, then probably they would end up in Brighton in May on the 3-week festival. One of the people I invited was Julie Fowlis. I had a vision, I mean, I'm from the Highlands, I had a vision there on the south coast that if Julie Fowlis came down and brought with her the sound of the landscape, the sound of the place that I know in my bones, you know, you put these two together, you have the north and the south just happen in that room. And she came and she sang to a room full of, I don't know, 800, 1,000 people. She said to the room, "How many people here speak Gaelic?" One guy right down at the front shouted, "Me." That was it, in the whole room. Then she taught us all a Gaelic song, and everybody in that room that night sang a Gaelic song.
That was Julie Fowlis singing Blackbird in Gaelic there. And tell me, Ali Smith, you said the Gaelic word for that song is
Long Du.
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Your books, of course, have won numerous literary awards. You've won the Whitbread, you've won the Saltire, you've been nominated for the Booker three times. Explain to us the Oh, I can only imagine it's a kind of specific torture once you are nominated, because you don't ask to be nominated. And then you find yourself on these shortlists and suddenly do you begin to care?
No, it's nothing to do with the book. It's like if you went into a department store and someone was really nice to you, you know, when you bought something and someone was really nice to you and you said goodbye and you felt better and you went out. That's nice. It lasts that much. And it just happens over there, like 3 miles away, and you can see something happening in the distance. As it gets closer, and depending on how much noise is around the thing, it's a bit like having a brass band playing reasonably close to your ear. You just have to ignore it. But there's a kind of acknowledgement of the randomness, an acknowledgement of a kind of communal, here we go, so what about it? And it really does feel random, and it's nothing to do with the actual process of writing the book.
And the process of writing the book then, you've said before that you're never sure if something's going to be a novel or if it's going to be a short story. Now, that seems very curious to me.
It depends what you're working on. The thing about a novel is it's rather like a giant hoover. It just hoovers up everything that comes through you. But the forms are really different. So, for instance, if I'm working in the novel form, again, it takes a great space of time and it wakes you in the middle of the night and you never stop thinking about it. You're never not accompanied by it. Short stories are shorter. Because they're shorter, they tend to be harder in a way. The end of the process of putting together, because short stories, I felt much worse than at the end of finishing a novel.
You mean physically?
You just feel tired. You just feel, right. And also the story presses itself up against mortality in the way that the novel presses itself up against society and continuance and sequence and consequence. And the story can be about all sorts of societal and sequential and consequential things too, but its form is short. And the novel's form, even if it's a short novel, is the novel form and it does something else.
And you say when you're writing a novel, it is never not with you. Are you able to be reading anybody else's literature at the same time as writing, or is your whole head taken up with
No, I love reading. I mean, I couldn't not read.
Right.
But when in the middle of a novel, I don't work on it at the weekends. And, I keep a pile of books and I choose randomly from that pile and just read whatever comes to the top.
Tell me about your next piece of music, Ellie Smith.
Okay. Oh, to choose a Dusty Springfield track, how difficult was that? But Dusty is definitely, definitely coming with me to the island. And I looked over the whole range of all the brilliant years, the Dusty Springfield years, and I thought I'll just start at the beginning with I Only Want to Be With You, partly because 1963, at this point, I'm kind of coming alive. And oh, what a joy to be coming alive to this.
That was Dusty Springfield and I Only Want to Be With You. So you were born, Ellie Smith, in Inverness in the early 60s. As I said in the introduction, you were the last of five and there was a big space between you and your siblings. Yeah.
It was big for my mum and dad. It was 7 years. They had their family, really, my two sisters and my two brothers, pretty much straight away after they got married. And then there was, 7 years, and then there was a Christmas. And
right.
Then there was me.
And how did you make your presence felt then in a group of five?
I can't imagine there would be a more perfect way to grow up, both only child and part of a very kind of glorious social structure.
I've seen a rather blurry family photograph in which I'm particularly interested right now in your mother. Can you bring her into focus for me?
She was beautiful. What shall I say? She was very proper and contained. She'd been born in the north of Ireland on the very north coast in Limavady, and she was the eighth child in a family of nine. Yes. And she'd come across after her father died with a couple of her siblings to work. So she'd got herself a job at the age of 14 on the buses going up and down the Murray Firth coast in the late 30s, early 40s. She did that, and then she joined the WAF.
And leaving school at 14, not uncommon, of course, mm-hmm. for many, many mm-hmm. People of that generation. Could she have stayed on? Was she a bright girl at school?
Both my folks were incredibly bright, intelligent people who had to leave school early because of deaths of fathers. They had that in common. They also had in common that they had been awarded scholarships that they could not take up.
And were stories part of your childhood? Did your mother read with you a
goodness.
Lot?
On a Saturday night, out came my mother's real glorious nature. We all had our baths on a Saturday night. I'm the small one. I get bathed. I sit on her knees, she'd wrap me in a towel, and then suddenly she just turns into another character. She kind of, she's kind of, doing a kind of humming noise, and then suddenly she becomes.
She's kind of evoking the spirits, is she?
She just was such a fantastic actress. She just turned into another person. She would turn into one of two witches who were called Gertie and Bella. She would turn into a woman from the Scottish Islands, and she would make a monologue which sounded like a kind of eulogy and a prayer. If she didn't turn into the characters, which was terrifying enough when you were 7 or 8 years old, she would start singing these Victorian songs about dead orphans just to make me cry. It reminds me of Dickens or something. She would suddenly sing, two little orphans, a boy and a girl, sat by the old church door. And of course, the orphans are going to die. You know,
of course.
And I would just be in tears. She was such a playful,
yes,
funny person who went through life with that playfulness.
There are many reasons why it's wonderful to have a mother who's playful. But for you, this idea that within us all are stories and imaginations and things that we let out from time to time, how useful for the beginnings of Ali Smith.
I know how much that means to me now. If I have an Irish literary heritage, it's come through my mum in that form, my God.
Let's have some more music, Ali. Your third. Tell me about this.
My third is Sylvie Vartan. She's singing Par Amour, Par Pitié. I loved French songs when I was in my teens. And this one reminds me of me and my friend Julie going off to Paris on Magic Bus, which cost like, I don't know, 10 quid or 5 quid to go to Paris and Amsterdam. We ran out of money. We sat down in the mouth of one of the metros and I played the mouth organ, Mr. Tambourine Man, and Julie sat there looking beautiful, and people gave us enough money to afford a hamburger. And we came back, and in my rucksack were a bunch of records, which were mostly bent out of shape because they were in my rucksack, and this was one of them.
On jet pas, un vieux jean musé. On recolle un livre abîmé. On regarde une photo ratée. Et on pleure sur une fleur séchée. Par amour ou par pitié.
Par amour, par pitié, sung there by Sylvie Vartan. Let me ask you, Ali Smith, about this idea of you, well, I believe it's true, you could read by the age of three.
I don't know if it's true. There was a story that my dad told, which was that one night he said, what's on TV? And I told him what was on TV by reading it off the TV pages. And they realised I could read and that I had learned to read, he said, via the singles, you know, the 45s that we had in a record bag, because if I knew the name of the song, I could see what the word was. And I'd also have taught myself from the TV programmes
because
that were on the TV pages.
Intriguing. I had thought that quite obviously that must have been a concerted effort by your parents to teach you to read.
No, not at all. Not at all. No.
You've explained a little bit about your dad's circumstances. Just tell me a little bit more about him as a person.
He was born in Newark in Nottinghamshire. And like my mum, he had been a clever boy whose dad died young. His dad had been in the First World War and was gassed a couple of times. Gassed once, then went back to war and got gassed again. So he died young and my dad had to come out of school and work. The war happened and he joined the Navy, became an electrician. And when he came out, he got a job up at the hydroelectric dams being constructed in the Highlands. And he'd met my mum before that. They met when he was wiring up a WAF station. And he was in the locker rooms of the WAF station with his mate, and they were putting up wires along the tops of the lockers. And his mate said, let's go through the lockers. And when they got to one locker where everything, my father used to say, was pristinely folded and beautifully arranged. And my father said, whose is this? I'm going to find that girl and I'm going to marry that girl. Anyway, he did meet my mum and he met her by chance. She was coming out of the shower. She had a towel around her head. And he took her out that night to the pub. And his mum had died quite recently. And he had in his pocket his mother's engagement ring in a box. He just had it about his person, and so he got it out and he showed my mum. He said, look at this. He said, this belonged to my mum and I've just got it, and she just died. Anyway, everybody around them in the pub went, oh, look at them, they're getting engaged. And they looked at each other and that was it. So they went up and they worked up and down Scotland on the dams, and then settled in Inverness, where he opened his own electrical contractors business and shop. And he was one of the main electrical contractors for the Highlands. I mean, he wired most of the houses up and down Loch Ness.
Did he ever see the monster?
Oh, he did see the monster.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he did.
You're saying that with almost a straight face.
My dad swore by it. My dad was a great storyteller, but he wasn't generally a liar about his stories. You know, there's a difference between lies and stories.
We understand the world when we're young through the prism of our families. Did you know writers? Did you realise that was a job? Did you think, I want that job?
No, absolutely not. There was one point I was sitting upstairs in my dad's shop and he called me downstairs and said, this is Alan Campbell MacLean. And, you know, he wrote The Hill of the Red Fox. And I shook this lovely man's hand and met his wife, and my dad had wired his house. When I got in the car to go home, my father said to me, I thought you'd like to meet him.
Interesting.
Yeah, I know.
And they had you down, obviously, as somebody who was a smart girl.
If they had, they never told me, because it wouldn't do to know if you were smart.
Well, you know, you're in Scotland.
Exactly.
Now.
Just, you know, don't get too smart for yourself.
So, Alison, let's have your next track. We're on your fourth. Tell me about this.
So now I'm thinking sort of chronologically forward to going to Aberdeen University. When I think about that time, it wasn't even that far from home. It's only 100 miles.
I know, I was going to ask you about that in a minute.
it's a world away. Off to the university to study English. And this song by Orange Juice brings back everything about the irony and the potential and the laughter and the danciness of that time in the early 80s up to the mid 80s, falling and laughing. Orange Juice.
That was Orange Juice and Falling and Laughing. And I have to say, Ali Smith, there's a certain listener of a certain vintage who'll be very happy that you've chosen Orange Juice. You chose it because of your university years. And as you say, you left Inverness and you went all the way to Aberdeen. it's just over 100 miles away. It's really not very far. Still in the Highlands of Scotland. Did you think about choosing somewhere else?
No, I was always going to go to Aberdeen. My mum and dad were very, very concerned that we all went through tertiary education, that they made sure that we had all had the gift that they had not been able to have.
And it was, I suppose, that sort of golden time for education in terms of the funding and so on.
Oh, it was glorious. Do you know what? If you think about now, and I hear about the kids coming out, and they're coming out to, in England, they're coming out to 53,000 now debt.
In terms of debt.
I mean, none of us would have been able to go. It just wouldn't have happened for us. I cannot believe the window of opportunity that history just opened so that we could squeak through at that point when education was what it should be, which is nothing to do with money.
You were doing a PhD and you chose not to complete it.
I did complete it, but it was referred, which means that I had to change it if I wanted to complete it.
Ah.
So it went to examination in the year after my mother died. So I was finishing it as my mother died. Got two jobs on the back of its first chapter, and then went to my viva and was told that the first chapter wasn't good enough and had to be changed. So then I thought, I just don't get this at all. So I stopped. At that point, my mum had died, and some of the pressure on me to get a job which was acceptable, to particularly to my parents, who wanted me to be able to pay my way and to be all right in the world. So there'd been pressure on me, as it were, to stay in the studies I loved, which was language and literature. I love it. But after the death of my mother and after that thing happening, I thought, well, there are other lives in language and literature. Lucky for me, in a way, there was another little window I squeaked through there.
And as close as you were, and it's clear to hear you talking about your parents, to your mother, was there, as people sometimes can feel, a sense that the responsibility is over now that they're no longer there, that actually maybe I can go and live a life that would have been harder for me to live if my mother had been here?
I'm sure that's true. And in a way, it sounds kind of heinous. And at the same time, everyone who's been in that situation will understand. We know what the word liberation means. Liberation is the thing that happens after a war. You know, you come through it and you are in pieces. But you are differently free. My father was much more philosophical in the world. My mother was very practical. You know, you got a job, you had a wage, that was you sorted. But my father was more philosophical. And so after my mum died, there was a point at which I was, as it were, liberated to go down a route which had not really, you know, been possible.
More to talk about in a moment. For now, Ali Smith, tell me about your next piece of music. We're going to hear your fifth.
Actually, we're talking about my mum, and this is called Daphne. It's a track by the Quintet of the Hot Club of France, Stéphane Grappelli and Django Reinhardt. Sarah, my partner, her mum was called Daphne, so it makes me think of Sarah's mum also. But it really, really makes me think of my mum. When this track came out, 1938, my mum would have been 10 years old. This is the child she would have been. Also, I love the playful, bright lightness of this, and again, it makes me think of my mum.
That was Daphne, composed and performed by Stefan Grappelli and Django Reinhardt. Ali Smith, in the late 70s and 80s, to be gay or lesbian was, for a lot of people in their different ways and with their different perspectives, an issue. You came from a Catholic background. You say your mother was in many ways a proper person. Mm-hmm. Was it ever an issue for you with your family?
It's funny thinking about it now. It's such a different world, and yet it's absolutely the same world, and we're all the same people, and yet it's so different. Oh my God, the difference between then and now. Small town, which then became a city, Inverness, beautiful town, living there and knowing that there is something that can't be said. And, you know, you've got real difficulty saying. Now, this, in a way, it's the heart of every Henry James novel that was ever written. It's like a perfect gift. It's like the gift of metaphor to write any narrative at all. You can't live your life like that. So there's a point at which I come home, 1984. So I'm, what, 22? And my mum says to me, "Is it true that you and your friend were seen holding hands at the theatre, down between the seats?" And then she said, "Tell me it isn't true."
Right.
And so I said, "It isn't true," because she knew perfectly well, and I knew perfectly well, that it was true, but she had wanted not to hear it. My dad was very different, and say 10 years later, I could feel him kind of frustrated with me for something. And we'd never spoken at all about my life as a gay person. And it surprised me. I realised actually he was frustrated because we hadn't, and because he thought that everybody else in the family knew something that he didn't. So I did. I started just to tell him about my life. And oh my goodness me, if we could be even more friends, we were.
You've written so beautifully in your book Shire. You give this description of a journey that you made with your father in his mini metro van, 1985. It's an October day, and you describe exquisitely travelling through the Grampians, the highlands of Scotland, as you travel south and south and south. You are on your way to Cambridge.
Mm. We set off at 6 a.m. and I had got a place at Cambridge, which I hadn't even seen a picture of. I'd just been given a place. You know, I'd finished at Aberdeen and I'd applied willy-nilly to several places, and I got a place at Cambridge, which came in a letter from a woman called Heather Glenn, which made me think that it was a joke. But it wasn't a joke, apparently. When I phoned up the number, they said, you know, it was true. So we got in the car mid-October and in my dad's mini metro van and packed with books and records, and we drove down the country. And as we drove down the country, the season changed. So it had been autumn in the Highlands, a beautiful autumn. Oh, just the kind of heartbreaking autumn where everything is misty and the mist is rising like a revelation. And as we came down the country, it got warmer and warmer and sunnier and sunnier. And we arrive in this city where people are wearing shorts and it's 22 or 23 degrees. And in fact, I understood for the first time why children in Enid Blyton books wore sun hats. Because before that, I just thought, you know,
they're making that stuff up.
Why are they wearing a hat?
Let's have your next piece of music, Ali Smith. What are you going to hear? This is your sixth.
Okay, my sixth. I love cinema. I love it. It's been a huge part of my life. And I also love the country, Greece. In times of my life when I've been in a rough way or I've been tired or I've really needed to change something, I've gone to Greece, and Greece has really, truly helped with that. Cinema and Greece come together for me in a memory of my dad, precisely because I really associate cinema with my dad, because as the electrician in Inverness, he wired up both the cinemas. Because he was the electrician, we had a free pass, so I got taken to see things several times. So cinema has been a huge, huge part of my life. Now, when my dad died in 2009, you know, it was a depressing time. It was quite a deep darkness. I got out of that deep darkness, as it were, by, in the middle of the night, watching on YouTube, clips from 1960s films, which were Greek musicals, a genre which, who knew it existed? And there's a particular star about whom everybody knows in Greece. You go to Greece and you say her name and it is like saying Brigitte Bardot, Sophia Loren, Catherine Hepburn. And somehow she picks up the traits and the senses of all of those actresses in what she does. She's incredibly versatile. Aliki Vouyouklaki. This is her singing a song called Tofegaraki, the little moon, or the moon, from a film called Isoferina, which means the lady driver.
Βγήκε και το φεγγαράκι που έχει το φως το χρυσαφί. Έχω απόψε ένα μεράκι και έχω και μια χαρά κρυφή. Φέρτε μου το φεγγαράκι που είναι σαν φλουρί χρυσό. Το μισό θα στο χαρίσω και θα κρατήσω το άλλο μισό. Θέλω απόψε να γνωρίσω.
from the soundtrack to Aesop Arena. That, do you know what, Alex Smith? You speak Greek. I don't.
I don't really speak
Would
Greek.
Would you like to do the back announcement on this track? Because I'll only muck it up and you'll be inwardly tutting as you hear me muck it up.
Do you want me to say this whole thing?
Yes.
I just know how to say it. I speak it, you know, like five-year-old Greek. So it's Tofengaraki from the soundtrack to Aesop Arena, sung by Aliki Vouyouklaki, composed by Erasimos Lavranos and Alekos Sakellarios.
Three cheers for that. Thank you very much. It's difficult, isn't it, to ask an author about writing in the same way that it's difficult to ask a painter about painting, because it's all there, really, in the book. Do you feel frustrated when people ask you questions about writing?
No, I remember when I asked people questions about writing and try and answer them as truthfully as I can, but actually it's very hard to answer them truthfully, because if you make conscious a process which is so joined to the unconscious, then you're stripping your unconscious of its power. There's that thing, number one. Number two, it's really hard to articulate what you're doing while you're doing it.
You spoke as we went into that piece of Greek music about times when, you know, you were having a rough time and you'd been tired. That happened not long after your mother died. She died relatively young. She was only in her early 60s when she died. Were you writing productively at that time, and did it sort of come to a halt?
No. She was only 61 and I was 27. I remember my dad saying to me, "You're lucky you had your mum so long." I was coming out into that particular academic life that I had thought would be my life and was meant to be my life. And it ground to a halt. I was working at the university in Glasgow, and it was a bit like I hit a wall. It was like, if you can imagine, you hit a wall and you just kind of crumple up and your muscles don't work properly anymore. So I just took to my bed. It was partly diagnosed as chronic fatigue syndrome, which I'm sure there's an element of. But do you know what? The people I know who've had chronic fatigue syndrome have had it much worse than anything that I experienced that year and the cycles after it. Very different.
Was it the exhaustion of extreme grief?
You know what? We treat grief incredibly lightly in this culture. And we mustn't. We have to know that, you know, grief isn't over in 3 weeks or 3 months. Grief is part of the bone structure of us, and it takes the years that, you know, that it takes. And it changes you. It actually transforms you. It's part of the transformative things that happen to us in our lives. So don't deny it, you know. But to give it a name, I have no idea what I'd call that. But what I'd call it now is the point at which one road stops, there was another road. Having had a rest, I find myself on that other road.
Tell me about your seventh disc. What are we going to hear now, Ali Smith?
You're going to hear my favourite song ever. It's been my favourite song since I was 12 years old. It was written by Yip Harburg. Most people don't know who Yip Harburg is, but they do. They know him all through their body, because he's the man who wrote Somewhere Over the Rainbow. He wrote Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? He wrote April in Paris. And he wrote Say It's Only a Paper Moon. I hold it close to my heart as well, because it's the song which Sarah and I, when we first started to work together in theatre, I wrote a play and she directed a play. In fact, I wrote several plays and she directed several plays. We used this song as one of the intros to one of the plays we did. So we have it as a kind of agreement between us, this song. And the song is about agreement. It's about how a commerce between people becomes a faith and a belief and makes the world not two-dimensional. Say it's only a paper moon sailing over a cardboard sea. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Ella Fitzgerald and the Delta Rhythm Boys.
Say it's only a paper moon sailing over a cardboard sea. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Yes, it's only a canvas sky hanging over a muslin tree, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
It's only a paper moon, Ella Fitzgerald and the Delta Rhythm Boys. We started today with a quote from you where you had said, you know, stories can change lives. We tell ourselves stories about our lives. We write our lives ourselves, and we choose what to edit out and what to reinforce and when to repeat an experience and when to leave a paragraph behind.
Exactly.
In the process of writing for us, what have you learned about yourself throughout the decades, do you think?
I don't read my writing. You can't read your own writing. All you do is see the mistakes and the annoying things and hope that something's working and not know whether it is. But I am a reader, and I feel like I've been made by a million books. I feel like any book that I've ever written has been kind of drawn together from everything I've read. And I don't mean just books. I also mean like the sides of pencils and the sides of buses and the things that catch the corner of the eye as we walk past them. We are made by what we read. We are made by what we take into ourselves. If there's anything at all in this body right now, then I'm going to thank all those books for it.
You're going to the islands.
I know, I can't wait.
The solitudinous will be welcome, I imagine. You're looking forward to that, are you?
I am. I hope it's warm there.
How would you pass your days? Are you somebody who would feel the need to, like your mother, sort of be neat, make order, get it spick and span? Or would you rather just let the whole place find itself?
I'm going to look for the creatures, is what I'm going to do, yeah.
Right.
So once you find a creature, then you're not alone. And also I'm going to look and see what the plants are, because it's going to be really interesting to see where I am and what's growing there and what the traces of the year are in the place. But I hope there's a beach.
I think there is. I can't promise anything to
you. Because if there's a beach, I can actually do some work.
Tell me about your eighth disc, Annie Smith.
OK, I will. Actually, it's about work for me, and it's glorious work. For the past 5 years, maybe, I've been listening to Beethoven. I love him in a way that surprises me, because for a lot of my life, I was kind of scared to go towards classical music. I thought I didn't know enough about it. And then I began to listen at the very beginning. You know, I love listening to a piece of Beethoven every day. And I listened to Beethoven. It just is like the gift of understanding, of layeredness. So my last piece of music is the last movement from the first symphony, Symphony No. 1, the Adagio, the Allegro Molto.
That was part of the final movement from Beethoven's Symphony No. 1, performed by the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. It's time then, Ali, for me to give you the books to my author, the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and what other book will you take along?
If I'm taking the Bible, can I take all the other holy books as well?
No, but you can choose which holy book you'd like to take if you don't want the Bible.
Why am I not allowed to take all the books?
Because no other castaway in our 75-year history has been allowed to do that, and I can't make an exception
for
you.
There has to be a first.
Well, it's not today.
All the holy books are coming under my arm. That's just one choice.
Which one would you like?
I can't answer. I'm taking them all regardless. And Shakespeare, obviously.
Right. Just to be clear to people listening, you don't get to take them all. You can either take one or none.
I have big pockets.
It'll be the Bible then. So what's your other book?
Oh, this is a one church room. My other book is going to be Ovid's Metamorphoses, translated by Mary Innes, which was a Penguin Classics translation from about 50 years ago, and is an absolute delight.
Right, that is yours then. You're allowed a luxury.
I'm going to take the Palazzo Schifanoia, which is a really beautiful 1400s frescoed palace in Ferrara, which is the most beautiful, beautiful place I have ever been.
It gives me great joy to say I shall give you that to take with you to the island.
Thank you.
Which single disc? I think I know the one you're going to choose, because you said it was your favourite. Which one will you save from the waves?
You're wrong. I'm going to take Beethoven.
Are you?
Yes.
Is that a late change?
No, it's not a late move. No, if I take Beethoven, I'll get a lot of work done.
Okay.
It'll do nothing but inspiring.
It's yours. Ali Smith, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you, Kirsty.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.
This is the BBC.